Welcome, welcome, welcome everybody to the Deconstructor of Fun podcast. Our guest today is Chris Hewish, president of Exola and also current interim CEO. Chris, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Mikhail. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, and this is an honor since you woke up, like you woke up probably before 5 a.m. You're currently in North Carolina and it's 5:20 there, 5:20 a.m., right?
It is. It is bright and early, so got up pretty much before the entire world out here. But that means that we are undisturbed and I can focus on having a great time with you.
Yeah, I can only say that probably I wouldn't even wake up to do my podcast at this time, but thank you so much for accommodating to absolutely insane schedule. And for those who don't know Chris has... in addition to being the president of Exola as the interim CEO, he has a long tenure. I mean, you have a long tenure in games industry, Skydance, Survios, DreamWorks, and a good 13 years at Activision. Started your career at GameWorks, where you got the job by writing the most interesting cover letter or like letter of recommendation from an orc to you, the young student who wanted to work at DreamWorks. So you're a true game executive, starting from the beginning of your career.
Yeah, thank you. Games have been my whole life. Basically grew up in a hobby store playing tabletop games. And that letter that you referenced, when I got out of university, took a shot at applying at my favorite company, which was Games Workshop. And having no experience to speak of, I wrote them a letter of recommendation from an orc war boss. And this orc war boss was recommending this disumin, you know, that's how they speak in the Warhammer universe, and recommending that they hire me. And much to my pleasure and surprise, they did, and found out that that letter actually really hit the nail on the head, because they were looking for people that were passionate about the core product. And this really displayed that passion. So that kicked off a great career and brings us to where we are today. So it's been a well-traveled career. And I'm just happy to come in and be able to share some thoughts and insights.
Yeah, I mean, it's always great talking to you. And I feel like we could talk about everything, because last time we talked, we were Gamescom. And I remember out of all the topics that we discussed, I think we discussed wearing a weighted vest or a rock when doing rock walks. So it's like it can go from anything in terms of topics, and from games to sports. And also, you know, everybody in the industry, like through you, I've gotten introduction to the likes of Goldman Sachs and have them, you know, had those interesting discussions. So we can, what I'm trying to say is like, there were so many topics to decide what we could talk about that I decided that let's just talk about everything. And so I went through your LinkedIn, and you've been naturally active on LinkedIn as any leader has to be these days. And you've been posting a lot of very interesting polls as well as write-ups about the industry and the implications of those. So I kind of selectively went through different things and created this sort of a rapid fire session. So would you like to attend? I mean, you can't say no now, but would you like to attend to a rapid fire session about the games industry?
Yeah, I guess it's a little late to walk away from my own firing squad here.
Huh? this is how we get executives to say anything. No, but yeah, that would be interesting to kind of go through what you've been writing, what you've been getting feedback on, and then talk about that in more depth.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to, you know, being able to cover a variety of topics and dive in. Happy to jump in with you here.
All right. Well, let's start with question number one. So this is, a lot of these could be a little bit on the negative side, but let's get some positivity into it. So the first thing that I want to talk about would be the macroeconomics of today and how that affects the gaming industry. I'm really curious about this just, you know, because of I studied economics and I always drift back to that. Those are the news that I like to read, the Wall Streets, the Financial Times, the Economist, and kind of looking at the macroeconomics of today and what has been going on for a few years now, there's a lot of factors that are affecting the games industry at a at a macroeconomic, also at a higher level. Number one, the inflation rate, meaning that the same money buys you less, and that forces companies who can to increase their prices. Number two is the interest rates. So because of the high inflation, the central banks increased the interest rate to decrease the money, the amount of money circulating in the economy. And in practice, that means that the mortgage prices have increased, the payments for cars have increased, as well as on the investment level, the appetite for more riskier investments such as crypto has decreased. Because if you keep your money on your account or on a specific account, that actually brings you safe return on investment through the interest. And then there's some US specific, and we're going to be quite US specific because that's the biggest economy of the world and so forth. So student debt payments during COVID time, they were stopped. And now they're set to reassume or to be recollected again. And that's, I think it's calculated to $100 billion at the moment annually that these payments will take. And we've seen a lot of strikes as of late. We've seen the Hollywood strike. We've seen auto workers being on strike at the moment. I think there's a game developer strike. And so a lot of this type of unrest that seems to come from just less disposable income, all these factors affecting less disposable income. And I'm very curious to hear your opinion on how these elements affect the games industry. I mean, I'm old enough to remember 2008 when we had the last recession, which was actually pretty much a boom for games industry. But how do you see these you know, economic downturn affecting our industry now?
Yeah, these are all great points. And you're right, you know, 2008 really sort of, while the rest of the economy and the rest of the world or different market segments were going down, games did see a lift. And that, you know, that has fed into a narrative that's been ongoing or persistent, where games are kind of a counter-recession industry, where they tend to do well when other industries go down. But we still need to keep an eye out for that. And, you know, as you pointed out, interest rates, you know, cost of things really have a big impact on the business. And I love talking about macroeconomics around the games industry, not to be doom and gloom. You know, we talked a little bit before we got on here and it's like, oh my gosh, this is all negative. We're running for the hills. But it's really important to keep it in mind when you're thinking about your business, because it can impact a whole host of things. You know, everything from if you're going out there trying to raise capital, how do you adjust your pitches? What kind of messaging do you lean into, or business plans do you lean into that might be appealing to investors? When we were in sort of the boom times of a few years ago, and as they say, capital was free, meaning that interest rates were near zero or extremely low. So it was very cost efficient to fuel things by borrowing money for investors. At that time, investors were much more willing to pay higher valuations on things. They were willing to invest in more experimental technologies or ideas or unproven teams. And that all happens when the market is kind of booming. But where we are now with interest rates up, looking at last year, I believe the interest rates in the US were 8.26%, up nearly 5% from their long-term average of 3.28%. And that means that the cost of that capital for investors gets more expensive because it costs more for them to borrow it from central banks or for their the people contributing to funds, the limited partners and whatnot. It costs more for them to, you know, to use their money, and that changes the kind of investments. So that's one area. If you're running a games business today and you're looking to raise capital, the investors are really looking for things that are sort of safer bets. They're looking to de-risk their investment as much as possible. So they're no longer investing in the hyper growth kind of initiatives. They're really investing in proven teams, profitable companies. So keep that stuff in mind, right? That's why I like to talk about macroeconomic conditions. But then, you know, you talked about some other things as well, like in the other impacts that inflation have. You know, inflation, just to remind everybody, is, as you pointed out, inflation is really, you know, when the cost of things go up, right, over a period of time, prices increase, and that translates to declined purchasing power. And that is becoming important these days as we're seeing a real squeeze on people when it comes to spending. You mentioned student debt. I think the average monthly student debt in the U.S. is $500 per month, which is a lot of disposable or discretionary income that can't be spent on games. And not only that, but the prices of the games could be going up. You mentioned, what was it, Capcom, I think you said?
Yeah. Capcom president said, he said this week, I think it was this week, was the statement that even though we've seen the price go from 60 to 70, and he was saying that that's not enough, like we need to keep increasing, because even though that is significant increase in price, it's not in line with the increase of cost of developing these games over the past decades.
Yeah, so there you go. You know, that's a great example of where inflation can have a real impact on the games industry, where those game prices are going up, and at the same time, disposable income is going down, and the value of the sort of the money or the wages that we make is also going down because inflation is going up. So it's a real squeeze. And, you know, it also can have an impact, even if, you know, you're out there, you're running a games business and you're saying, you know, well, I'm not really raising the price of anything in my game, so I'm not passing that cost on to the consumer. Well, the reality is that even if in-game currencies stay stable and inflation's going up, they are getting more expensive because the absolute value of those items, even though the number has stayed the same, the impact it has on the consumer has gone up. So this can create some real sort of deflate or inflation on your in-game currency as well that hurts your overall game business. So it's just something to keep an eye on. No specific recommendations, but whenever running a business, it's like we're part of this macro economy, and it's something that people really need to keep keep track of.
Yeah, those are really good points. So especially with those who are raising the capital. So as you mentioned, the de-risking, the having the proven business model, proven team, really focus on getting to revenue fast. And the second point is like when we are being compared as an industry to 2008 recession, 2008 was drastically different in terms of entertainment that was provided to people compared to 2023. I mean, we didn't have Netflixes, we didn't have all these subscription services, we didn't really have mobile phones and free to play back in the days. Like we had paid products, and at that point, if you went out and bought your Call of Duty, that gave you a lot of time, or Madden or FIFA, that gave you a lot of entertainment for the same value. But at the same time, like, you know, we have now services that are almost mandatory for some people, whether we're talking about Tinders, whether we're talking about Spotify's, you know, as I said, the Netflixes and some other subscription services. These all take from the diminishing disposable income that people have during the recession. So that is the challenge I feel like the game industry is facing at this point. And kind of continuing from that is like when you have higher interest rate and when getting money is more expensive, it exposes a lot of businesses that were not being that were relying on cheap capital in the sense so they could grow while not being profitable. So blitzscale, if you will. And one of those businesses is, of course, our dear Unity, that I think was it last week or a week before, had objectively the biggest communication blunder of the year, I would say, so maybe over the couple of years, something that forced them to backtrack their communication. They took tremendous brand damage, and just in terms of monetary value, they lost 25% of their stock, which accounts to my quick calculation to about $3 billion, give or take a few hundred millions here and there. So the underlying reason why Unity went to this route, in my opinion, is that the fundamentals of that business have been off since the beginning, and they're just now exposed because they can't go to the money market and just get few billions more of cash of cash basically to continue growing the revenue despite being increasingly less profitable. And that fact that their core business is not profitable, and the fact that they've spent, I think, I might be wrong, but I think the number was around $4 billion in different acquisitions, out of most of which haven't been able to diversify their business enough and bring those growth areas, apart from the ads business that has been extremely successful with the acquisition of Amplifier here in Finland that became Unity Ads, as well as the acquisition of Iron Source that allowed them to really scale this ads business. So what's your take on Unity, and what do you think? Are we going to see more companies that have been unprofitable to kind of force themselves to be profitable, and that coming in as a shock to the ecosystem? Like, oh, I thought this was free. It's like, no, it's not.
The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, gosh, you know, Unity, I'm a big fan, right, of Unity and what they've done for the industry and in sort of democratizing the ability for people to make games and get them to market, right? So the engine and the technology is fantastic. But you're right. I mean, that was a still, you know, as somebody who does a lot of messaging, I am still trying to figure out what that strategy was in the approach to putting that messaging out and putting that plan out. I mean, they have done a good job, I think, over the past week of clarifying and refining that a bit and shifting it to more of a revenue share fee if people are interested and all of that. But you touched on, I think, you know, and this links back to the macro stuff, macroeconomic part of it is, you know, there were companies that when we were in these low inflation rate or low interest rate periods, companies were really focused on hyper growth. And that was this narrative. That's what investors were looking for. And there's this thing called multiples that a lot of people are probably familiar with, where these multiples sort of establish a valuation for your company. And they're really impacted by how investors view the potential for the business. And we had these multiples that were much, much higher a few years ago for tech companies. And now those have come down. And that means that not only are these companies worth less, but the, as we said, that access to capital is down. And in the case of somebody like a Unity, who's been focused on the narrative of sort of hyper growth and market share and all of that, they now really need to figure out how are we going to generate revenue and shift to a narrative talking about profitability and what is our margin, you know, very much P&L management and profit and loss management versus the growth management. And that forces companies to come up with new ways to generate more revenue. And, you know, I'm not saying this saying applies to Unity, but it's a saying that I love and it applies generally in this situation. And you mentioned it, a lot of companies kind of are being caught and called out now and facing some issues. But there's a saying that somebody I worked with in the past had said, which is success is a great deodorant, right? So I feel like success in the sense of, you know, hyper growth or generating a lot of revenue for some other companies that might be down. But that success of the hyper growth phase kind of covered the fact that a lot of these companies don't have great core business plans that are going to generate additional revenue. So a lot of people are now scrambling to figure that out. And I think that's what we saw with Unity. You know, obviously they've got a great place in the industry. I think, you know, we all know there's a lot of probably competing ideas inside the company on how to grow it. And it's been interesting to watch this play out. But I do like the shift to with their pro and enterprise developers shifting to an option of just doing a revenue share fee, you know, similar to what Unreal, right? Epic has done with Unreal.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I don't think Unreal is profitable either in terms of the Unreal Engine. So it's always a little bit of a confusing when I hear these propositions of whether you should build your own engine or whether let's use this or that. These are not good businesses as a business themselves.
No.
So It's quite quite difficult position where Unity put themselves in, but they also succeeded perfectly on the strategy of the past decade, which is blitzscaling, which is just taking over the market by being excellent at raising capital. And I don't think there's many people that are better than that than JR, who has been able to sell the company over and over and over again with multiple different positioning. And that led to the multiples that you were talking about. And multiples is the valuation. The valuation of Unity has gone to about 200 billion, I think it was at some point. At least the stock was, the stock was worth 200 a piece, and now it's 30. So I'm not sure what the valuation is, but from 200 to 30, that is a quite of a drop. And then what happens is you can't take as easily money off the market, and money is more expensive because your valuation is lower. Like, you're borrowing against an asset, and if the asset depreciates so significantly, now you have to figure out your core business. So it's all tied. That's what we talked about, macroeconomics, and then how that exposes the company. Chris, I think you checked the valuation.
I did. I just pulled that up. So you're right. So currently its market cap is $11.68 billion.
Oh.
And it's off of $30.45 US per share. And you're right. It was back in November of 2021, it hit the all-time high of close to 200. So that is a significant, significant drop. And, one of the things you mentioned, which I think is a great point for anybody who's running a games business to keep in mind, John Riccitiello has done a fantastic job of raising money, as he pointed out, over the years. And one of the bits of advice that I had got from somebody on the banking side of things as to why he's able to do that is he is always out there talking with the different investors and the bankers, all the sources of capital, building up a relationship. And this is a lesson that I think can be taken for any business of any size, whether it's talking with your community or talking with investors or whatever, just that communication, keeping an open dialogue, beginning that dialogue early, not just when you need something, but building up a rapport. And at least the way that I had heard it is JR was able to go out and do these raises because he had already established a rapport. He was a known quantity. The business was known to all of these people, all of these investors, before he asked for a raise. And then when the time came to raise money, he was able to pick up a phone, and if people already knew him, they knew the business, they knew what had been happening for the past X amount of time, months or years with the business. So he didn't have to go out and sort of introduce himself and pitch, a raise at the same time. So I think that was he's really smart about that. And that's something you see a lot of successful companies doing, where they just take the time to build that rapport before they actually need anything. And it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, it's good that you raise it, because it's quite often undervalued by general public, the role of a CEO in ability to raise funds, because with funds you have nothing, and it's always underplayed a lot. Like, whether it's Scopely, for example, they've done multiple rounds before they exit to Savvy Games Group, and you could say, well, Walter Driver, he doesn't know much about games and this, and it's like, it doesn't matter. He gives the fuel for the company to continue growing round after round, and each round becomes much more difficult, and operating or running the company becomes also more difficult because your board is expanding with so many stakeholders at bay. I think towards the end they must have had like 100 funds at Scopely.
It's amazing.
But it's a testament to people like JR and Walter and many others, whether it's CEOs of Ubers and Lyfts, in their ability to convince the market by having both the social capital as well as the performance capital that builds the trust with the market, allowing these companies to grow faster than they would if they would be simply profitable and fueling it with their own, bankrolling their own growth. And there's different ways to do things. Interest rate exposed this at some point, and it just allows forces the companies to shift their focus from growth of revenue of top line to growth of profitability of EBITDA. So that's the case of it. So yeah, I just wanted to give another side where people are always downplaying, well, it's all debt money. It's like, try to get 10 million, try to get 100 million, try to get a billion from the market. Like, you have to be pretty good at selling if you can get those type of numbers.
Exactly. So see, there is justification to go out and play golf. So that's
Yeah. And all these boondoggles, all these events where you meet people and have dinners and so forth. And it's like the relationships that these CEOs and these executives have built over decades as you know, honestly, like value in their weight of gold in that sense, because these companies.
It really is. And you touched on the boondoggles, and I know that's a running sort of, you know, joke, right? But you know, to translate this into something that's really, I think, actionable for a lot of the game developers out there who are running businesses, who might be listening to this and saying, well, that's great, you know, but I'm not looking to raise $1 billion right now. Someday, but not right now. But what, you know, this is still actionable now in the sense of, you know, going to events, you know, getting your, just becoming a known quantity within the industry, because you may, you know, it may then make it easier to work with an ad service, or you may be able to get a cross promotion, or there may be something else out there, right, that allows you to pick up a phone or send an email, and when you need it, and know that that person's going to respond back and help you out. So it doesn't have to just be about raising money. It really is anything that can help you do your business. And the takeaway is, you know, if you're a known quantity and people know your business or know your game, and they know that you've been around for a little while, they're much more likely to help out than if it's a cold call. I mean, we've all been there, right? You send out this just a cold email or cold LinkedIn message, and it's like, yeah, I'm not going to get a response. So
I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. I'm a big fight fan, so it, to me, it brings the element of promotion that goes into in the fight business, whether we're talking about boxing or UFC these days. It's like there are two types of successful fighters. There are those who, quote unquote, let their fists do their talking, aka the martial artists. And then there's those who are good at promoting themselves, aka shit talking. And then the best ones are both. So they can talk the talk and they can walk the walk. And of course, we're not talking about only being able to sell. You need to be also to deliver. And when those two things combined, that those type of people can truly spin up great businesses because of their connections and because their performance capital that has shown that they can deliver upon what they say they will. So in that sense, like you can take both paths, but I'm just very... from a lot of game developers, they want to focus just on making that great game. That's important as raising what I'm trying to say. And oftentimes, it's not even up to you if that game will be great. Things can shift in the market. Platforms can come and go. There can be shift in people's preferences. Or Pokemon Go can launch on the same week as you do. Or Diablo 4, stuff like that. And those will have significant impact on years of your work. And so not everything is in your hands, and I would encourage people to do both and just find their perfect medium in how much they want to do the promotion and how much they want to focus on the work. But I think both are important for any type of a leader.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And gosh, now I'm going to be, you know, thinking about Muhammad Ali and float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, right? So he was great at both.
No, nobody's dating themselves when they quote Muhammad Ali, but that's a great example. He was a great fighter, but he was also a great talker.
Yes.
And when those two things combine, he became magnitude larger than his opponents that were great fighters.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's switch gears back. I have a question about something that you had on your LinkedIn. It was about behavioral economics and gaming. I think you wrote quite an interesting post about it on Medium. And for folks that they're maybe not that familiar with behavioral economics, it's the field of economics that combines the insights from psychology and the economic study to and economics to really study how people make decisions in the real world situation. Because when we talk about economics in a very traditional sense, it always assumes that individuals are very rational. They always maximize their utility. As an example, if I go in and buy a soft drink, let's say I want to buy a Coke tasting soft drink, I would probably take the cheapest with the flavor that I like. But in real life, the decision is driven by such a multitude of factors. And this was actually a simple example, but factors like bounded rationality, meaning that I haven't like people just don't have enough time to investigate every single thing to make the right decision. And we use a lot of mental shortcuts to make those decisions. There's cognitive biases, you know, with whatever decisions we make, we can have overconfidence. We can seek certain arguments that support our existing mental models. And then there's, of course, the social and mental factors that we all have. And they play a huge role because these are things that set certain norms. They set up peer pressure. They can cause emotions like excitement or fear. And all these things are not actually covered by traditional economics. But you had a very interesting thing, how behavioral economics and games fit together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is something that I really believe in. I think when you're looking at your games business, looking at other industries and other just areas of expertise, right, of what you can draw in. And behavioral economics is a big one. And I know a lot of the product managers and monetization experts out there are already all over this, but it is something that a lot of game developers should always be aware of, even if you're not an expert in it. But this idea that the way your players behave, the psychology of how they interact with your game, how you are building your monetization, when you're presenting offers to them, there is a psychology to all of that. And it really can benefit your business if you understand it. And you're referencing a thought starter article that I wrote called Hey Big Spender. And this one was really around some of the tools that you can use with behavioral economics. And it was really triggered by when I was thinking about this, a friend of mine, you know, air quotes, a friend back in the day playing an MMO who never really hadn't paid for anything in a game. I remember that they were presented with a limited time offer for a unique mount and after achieving something big in the game and the offer combined and they went ahead and purchased and it converted them mm-hmm. From a player to a payer. And this offer combined rarity with a sense of achievement. And it played on something called the scarcity principle of behavioral economics. And this is a principle where things are kind of a scarce resource. They're only available at a certain time. And I'm butchering the principle, but that was the key takeaway. And it was used in sort of the design and when to present this offer and resulted in an actual purchase. So, you know, behavioral triggers can really influence a lot of in-game spending. And there's a lot of research around this. There's actually a number of studies and reports around personalized reward systems, bonuses based on gameplay styles, engagement, all of that. In particular, I was referencing the State of Personalization 2023 report, and they had some great data points in there where 56% of consumers or players will become repeat buyers after a personalized experience, which is amazing. That's a very powerful thing. McKinsey did some research. They found that some of the fastest growing companies drive 40% more of their revenue from personalized offers than slower growing competitors. And additionally, businesses report an average of a 38% increase in spending when an experience is personalized. So personalized experiences are another thing around behavioral economics of whether it's personalized at the timing or personalized to the player's play style, right? Or things like that. So really, really good stuff to keep in mind. And then, you know, finally, a good business case, a real world example, our friends over at Tilting Point with Star Trek Timelines, they use limited time offers to create a sense of urgency in really effective ways. And then of course, our friends at Epic with Fortnite, they're always rotating the items in their shop. And that really leans into the FOMO principle, the fear of missing out, which is a real thing, right? Where people really can get caught up in fearing they're going to miss out on something. and that'll drive a sense of urgency to go ahead and make a purchase. So a lot of different psychological tools that are proven. We see a lot of this in general e-commerce outside of games. And I think it's really powerful to pull in to your games business.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I mean, this has been on in product management craft since I started, like in 2010, back in Facebook games. But what we had and what I found was more useful than, let's say, bringing a behavioral economic expert into the company, because they don't understand that business that much and they're not that interested in your business. They're interested in their own craft. What we did, we read the books, and by read, I mean skim. And we created the tables of all these factors that are at play within the behavioral economics, like the cognitive biases and bounded rationalities and social emotional factors. And then we would answer ourselves in our games and use examples from others, like what type of a feature or workaround, whether it's a sale or a feature, either way, or a pop-up, like how can we tap into these emotions and what are the examples of it, and then try to come in. And I think that was a great way to build a sort of a model of your monetization and engagement features, rather than looking at Fortnite and be like, oh, I really like this rotating store, but you don't understand the theory behind it. And it was kind of like more helpful to understand a theory, present an example, like we would go and find out examples or just have that in mind when we're playing different games and come up with that example. And then go with the team, just go in like, hey, look at what they're doing. This is the theory behind it. What would be our version of this? And that resulted in a much more innovative responses rather than copies. And I felt like it increased the understanding of the whole team in this aspect of app development, to be honest. But my question to you is more like, is there any specific books that you would recommend, or podcasts, or some shows that people can get into to understand better behavioral economics?
Oh man, I mean, there's certainly a ton of material out there. There was a good article on UXReviewer.com that I looked at recently, where they talked about five incredible game monetization sort of techniques based off behavioral economics. There is also a good article by a gentleman named Lloyd Melnick, talking about behavioral economics for gaming companies. And this was maybe related a little bit more to social games and casino games, things like that. But the principles, I think, still apply. So there's a ton of material out there for people to dive into. And I love your point, which I think is really salient, around not just looking at other games and copying what they do, but having a bit of an understanding of what is the principle that's being put into practice here, and figuring out what is the best application for your game, right? And it may not be just if you're looking at a rotating store in Fortnite, that comes with a whole host of other things that you may not be able to actually put into play with regards to the volume of content, or maybe the timing of those offers is appealing more to their demographic than your demographic. So it gets pretty nuanced. And I think that was a great point that you made around just understanding those behaviors and those principles, and then crafting them around your game and what makes sense for your audience.
Yeah, it's more about my prior mistakes and in terms of like my own understanding of things, and not understanding that the team doesn't understand what I understand. And so I got into a point of like, let's just level our understanding so that we can work together. Cause otherwise there's like a disparity where I'm showing something and they don't get the theory behind it. And I think that they should understand the theory, et cetera. So as much as possible, give people context, and it'll get much better results through that. So
yep, exactly.
Learning. All right. UX reviewer. That's actually by Om Tam Don. He's been writing for Deconstructor of Fun sometimes. He's great stuff from him. And Lloyd Melnick, he's also written to Deconstructor Fun, and I'm a big fan of his content. He's more in the social casino side of things. Mm-hmm. And if something is deep into human behavior and exploiting that, that has to be casino. So Lloyd is very much, his blog is fantastic. So Lloyd Melnick, fantastic stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
So
and I think those are, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think, another, those are fantastic. I think another thing that people can do is just simply look around for real life examples. I mean, previously I'd written about some of the lessons that could be learned from the concierge service. Like when you look at hotels or restaurants, they employ a lot of behavioral economics as well in how they run their businesses. Also a lot of things that apply to running sort of a live service oriented business. So, if you don't want to get out there and read a lot of stuff, you can still see this in practice in a lot of other industries, and just keep an eye open for, how other businesses treat their customers, how they present offers to them, or how they make, their customers feel special. And that's a whole nother side of behavioral economics that people can pull from real life day-to-day experiences.
Yes, yes. That reminded me of my first year as a PM and the senior PM. Shout out to Timur Hausila, who's been at Supercell for a decade now, but he took me into a supermarket and explained, like, this is, like, look at these things, and these are all behavioral. I was just floored. I was like, no, I just thought that we were just, supermarkets are supermarkets. But then you start viewing things in a totally different way, where things are placed, how they're communicated, the packaging, all that type of stuff. So that kind of opens up the door. But I would still suggest that you should read. It's not enough to take it. Then you're at superficial level if you just start copying things or stuff. Like when you read, you'll start seeing all of this around you, and then you will notice that the concierge service is this service is like that, and then you start noticing mistakes in the behavioral economics that they're not doing that they should be. Whether you're at a masseuse parlor or you name it, it's like you'll see the world in a different way afterwards. So that's also a dangerous thing.
It is. Yes, to have the curtain pulled back. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. Everything is theory after that, and it's problematic.
This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor Fun really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing the full-on deconstructing first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fun, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fun are huge fans of Data AI. So what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free.
Okay, so jumping then to another topic, like we're all over the place. Let's talk about transmedia. And this is also one of those hot topics that have been as of late due to the fantastic success of Mario the movie. We got Days Gone. We got Arcane. We got success on the game side with some of the Marvel games, some of the Star Wars games. And it kind of erases the not so fantastic success of things like the World of Warcraft movie, the Halo show that was on Amazon Prime. Like, we don't talk about that. And my own personal experience of working on two IP-based games. So I worked on a game called Angry Birds Rio. So in conjunction to that Rio game, the only Angry Birds without the pigs and the Cruise game. So both definitely not tier one IPs by any magnitude, but the approval process and working with IPs is a whole different ballgame. Like, you have to be in touch with Hollywood all the time about every update you do, about all the ads that you run, and even about the business model that you employ. And so my kind of take on this, and I'm curious to hear your opinion, is like the correlation between the success of a show and success of a game. There seems to be that type of a correlation that is communicated, but is that success, justify the investment you have to make, both in terms of the development part, as well as just the live operations and the uh, and the ongoing relationship and the payments that sometimes you need to do to the IP holder. So kind of curious to hear how you view Transmedia and what it is now and what is the future.
Sure. So, I mean, this has been a big part of my career. I've worked on both sides, both as a licensee and a licensor within this business. And I'm going to dive into all of that in a moment. And I'm going to come back to that crudes part. but I did run a recent game poll about this. And, you know, it was really, this was triggered earlier in the year by the announcement of the Twisted Metal streaming series. Mm. And, you know, at the time, there was a lot of excitement around, you know, the different IPs that had been really successfully brought over to linear content. And I was really surprised that 75% of the respondents on LinkedIn were expressed excitement for more game-based, you know, linear content, more games being turned into shows. And I think that marks kind of a big shift because, as you pointed out, in previous years, we definitely remember a lot of failed attempts at bringing games over to linear IP media and the other way around, right? Translating shows or movies into games. And, you know, that really highlights, I think, there's not just a business model where, there's, you know, I remember back in the day at Activision when we were licensing IPs for ridiculous amounts of money. And then when I was at DreamWorks, on the other side of it, getting these licensing deals, I believe one of the first deals I did had a minimum guarantee of around $30 million. Wow. for a brand new animated movie, right? Not even a franchise. It was just unbelievable. And, you know, the problem is that has a real impact. That licensing fee up front has an impact on the money that goes into development. It comes straight out of, you know, what you're going to use to develop the game, market the game. Because you're still working with a P&L at the end of the day that has to make sense. So that expense is often viewed as a marketing expense and somewhat a development expense. And that can really impact the overall quality. Fortunately, I think we've moved past that quite a bit. And you see a lot of deals these days that are more revenue share based, which is great. And kind of brings to the second part of it where going either way, whether you're making a game or making a show, it really is all about understanding what is the core sort of fantasy or value proposition coming out of that IP. If you're going to take a movie or show and turn it into a game, what's the core play fantasy that players have? That's something I've long been an advocate of. We actually did a game called Turbo. I worked with a company called Pickpock back in the day. And when I was at DreamWorks, we took our Turbo movie, which was it's an animated movie about a snail that races, right? And turned it into a really successful mobile game, which this was back, I believe, in 2011 or so, and maybe 2011. And this game ended up getting over 100 million downloads, really popular, great engagement. We didn't really monetize it all that well because it was coming from a media company, which is more concerned about reach. But it did well because we leaned into the core play fantasy that came out of the film, right? It wasn't, we didn't even touch the whole story of the snail trying to get to race at like the Indianapolis 500 or anything like that. It was, let's just get this idea of snails that are tricked out on Hot Wheels type tracks, right? And that was fun. And that worked. But when it doesn't work, I think we've all seen that as well. And I'll loop back to our crudes. I didn't realize you worked on Croods. I was on the other side. I was on the other side at DreamWorks. And, you know, I was not thrilled with how that hat came about either. I think, you know, from the DreamWorks side of it, I had to do a ton of education within, you know, with the directors and with the creative executives around what are games. What is free to play? Because that was the first game that Rovio did that was free to play, right? If I remember right.
Yes, fully free to play. Yes. Yep.
And I created this big, thick binder, and I went around the whole company giving presentations so that they could understand, like, okay, there's this whole free to play thing. We need to create an economy, and they're going to create a lot of additional assets and things that, you know, the players can we can use to sell to players and all of this. Because, you know, they were coming from a film standpoint, which was, oh, just tell the story, right? Recreate the story. Everyone loves the characters. And it's like, well, you know, maybe in linear content, it's kind of the characters and the story and then the setting, right, in that kind of priority. But it's turned around in games, right, where it's often about the setting more than anything. And then what's happening within the setting and then the characters maybe is a third priority. So, you know, I think there's a lot of lessons learned. And if people do lean into what is core to the fantasy of that property and bring it over to games, if it's a play thing, or bring the characters maybe and the interactions within the game to more of a story element on linear, then it can work. But too often both sides just have no idea what's going on with the other. And
yeah, it's you mentioned a lot of things, the deal structure, that how that affects the development, the understanding of the core fantasy and being able to design around what the movie or the show or that part of creators have created. And then there's the different goals. With the media, it is the reach. With the studio, it is the revenue. And neither of them might understand each other's business model that well. And going back to that crude example, like I quit just before that game launched because it was just, it was such a horrific project. We didn't have really, I think we had 6 months of time to make and launch the game, not mm-hmm. like soft launch or anything, just, and first free-to-play game out of the studio. It was one of those things where there's just a miscommunication between the studio and the executives. And it was promised to DreamWorks by the CEO of Rovio, like, yeah, we're going to, you know, at that time, Rovio was really pushing into entertainment. So it made strategically sense to promise that. But clearly the message didn't get through to the CEO in what stage that development was and how feasible it was to deliver upon the promises that were being made. And, you know, the quality of the team back then, there was not a lot of senior people. So that was pretty crazy of a project. And a lot of people ended up leaving after that game.
Yeah, launched. I'm with you that I don't think anybody was happy at the end of the day on that. And it was certainly driven by more, I think, strategic initiatives. The pitch I always had was, you know, and I understand at the time there had already been like Angry Birds Rio and whatnot. But mm-hmm. for me, it was like, why not Angry Birds Croods? Go back to where it began, do a prehistoric, you know, sort of Angry Birds yeah. type of thing, just from a player perspective, because I loved Angry Birds. I think, and you highlight another pitfall that happens a lot of times is just a mismatch in strategic sort of priorities. And often IP can be viewed as I think wrongly people view it as a way to kickstart a new strategy or a new line of business, because the IP itself will be such a big name that it can draw more people in. But that overlooks the simple fact that you need a solid team and game before anything else.
Yeah, exactly. And you need a solid, like it doubles the risk, because you need a great show or a great movie, and you need a great game. It can't be that one is great and the other isn't. And so that's why it's always it's always just like a huge risk when you're doing both, because you can make a pretty good game, but if the media really, or if the movie or the TV show doesn't really break or isn't that good, that's not going to be good for the game. And vice versa, if you make a, you know, great movie or a great TV show and people are really into it and they open up the game and it doesn't deliver at all against the core fantasy, then it's going to be a huge disappointment for the movie as well, because now that's going to backtrack to them. It's like, why did you do such a stinker of a game? And so that's it's just the doubly the risk. And I can only imagine how difficult it is to work at Bad Robot or Skydance or any of these top tier what are they called, publishing houses, or, you know, the Hollywood studios.
Yeah, exactly, the content studios. Yeah,
to have this third party developing. And that's why many of them are kind of teetering always between, like, are we going to do it ourselves? Are we going to have a second party? Are we going to first party? Are we going to outsource? And it's always always a challenge, because the aspirations are so high for both of the products.
It is, you know, and I think for anybody out there that is working with IP, you know, a couple of things to always keep in mind. You know, I always like to advise teams to sort of set aside about 20% of their budget and their time and earmark that simply for the approval process, for change requests, right? You know, that there's more time because you have to get things approved. And then there's going to be requests that come back to change things, and that's going to cost more money. And then the other part is, and this trips people up, I've seen a lot of times, is, you know, make sure that if you're creating a game based on an IP, that you know who's actually seeing and approving your game on the other side. Because what sometimes happens is the licensing person might be the only person at the company who's, you know, doing the approvals, looking at the game until some big milestone, right? Maybe till you get to your alpha of the game, and then they'll take it to the IP holder, right? The director or the studio head or whomever. And that might be the first time those people see the game, and you could get massive changes that come back from that. So that's something that is always worth trying to de-risk, make sure that the real decision makers, not just the licensing person, but the people who really own and control the IP are aware early on of what kind of game you're making. Take some time to educate them, because at the end of the day, that's the final approval. And you don't want to get near you halfway through development only to find out that someone doesn't even want you to make that kind of game. Because
yeah, that's quite disruptive, to say the least.
Definitely.
All right, great advice on that. Second to last question, the impact of generative AI on creative workflows. Do you think it's a disruption? Do you think it's incremental innovation? What do you think are the implications of this? Because when you hear executives talk about this, due to very obvious and understandable reasons, they have kind of like two scenarios that they talk about. It's one is it allows the same amount of people to do more. So basically, this is a new tool that we're going to add, and we can build bigger worlds. We can develop a little bit faster. We can get rid of certain processes that have been eating out our time. And then there's maybe startups that are saying we can do more with, or not startups, but we can, yeah, startups. We can do more with less people. And sorry, I need to do this again. 3, 2, 1. So there's kind of two narratives with this, or actually three narratives. One is it allows the same amount of people to do more. And this is especially larger studios with the larger workforces are telling this type of a story, that when they want to build bigger games in the future, and every generation always builds a bigger game, with these added tools, they can keep roughly the same amount of people and produce bigger games. And then there's the sort of a startup story where less people can do the same as bigger studios, and that allows them to raise more capital because their aspiration level is higher, but the cost structure is a little bit of a lower than their competitors. And then there's a narrative that a lot of people are not talking about, but for sure executives have to talk about, especially in the current environment where the costs have been going up so significantly. And that is AI can allow less people to do more. And that, I think, is the one why we're seeing the Hollywood strike, or I'm not sure what the situation with that. It seems like they agreed on something already, but we were probably seeing some other strikes in the industry or in other industries, because the direct implication of this is you just need less people to do what you were doing before, or even more. And naturally, executives don't want to talk about this because, well, it's stressful. They don't know the exact answer to it, and it can cause a lot of issues in terms of adaptation of AI, because if people know or have a hunch that this is gonna have them or their colleagues let go, then why would they start using this tool? And kind of like, and as an executive, like, what is your perception of the AI going forward?
Yeah, I mean, this certainly is sort of a hot topic at the moment, and this was another thing that I ran on the game poll. And 66% of the people who responded said that they were using AI in their workflows now, which is pretty amazing. It's a lot higher than I thought. Obviously, that stat means a lot of different things. But before really diving into all of that, just from my perspective, I think, you know, I think AI at the moment, a lot of people look at it as an efficiency play when you're thinking of executives. And, you know, obviously, we're always looking at ways to improve margins, and that ties back to the macroeconomic environment that we talked about. And, you know, I think if people see AI as a way to sort of rein in some of the out of control costs that are going into these big games, right? AAA game budgets. You mentioned when we were talking prior to this that these budgets, when you develop and market, are getting close to the $1 billion mark to bring something to market. And, you know, of course, if you're sitting there at a big company and you're looking at having to put that kind of cash on the table to bring something to market, if AI can help sort of save even 20% of your costs, that's pretty significant, right? So, you know, I think there's a promise there, but, you know, from my own personal belief, you know, looking back historically at every time a new quote unquote efficiency product came to market, you know, whether it was computers or, you know, even the Industrial Revolution, right? Everybody at one point or another thought, oh, this technology is going to make so many jobs go away and we're going to work 4 or 5 hours a day and live a life of leisure, right? And the machines are going to do everything for us. But the reality is it just meant more work for everybody and the products got bigger and more refined, right? And, you know, for me, my personal belief is that AI is probably more aligned with that. Okay, we can, you know, on the one hand, it's going to allow a lot of, I think it'll really help support this forever game kind of shift where, okay, now we can start to produce content on an ongoing basis, more cost effective, but the overall effect is more content, right, around big games. But then on the flip side, I think for smaller developers, this is where I'm really excited. I think it continues. It's just another tool that'll help level the playing field or democratize, right, the business of games where we've already seen it with Unity and Unreal, where smaller teams of 15, 20 people can make, you know, these AAA games that have really big, right, impact and do extremely well. And I think AI just can help that even more, right? And potentially around the live ops side of it, where I think it will really be able to help a lot of these smaller teams just make games that they can then support basically forever. And, you know, the way that I look at it is, you know, you still need a core team that's going to create those hero assets and that core gameplay, those core systems. But then AI is a great way to take that and really scale it. So for me, it's more scaling, increasing the content, increasing the power of smaller teams to do great things. And that's where I'm really excited about it. And, you know, I think obviously there's some dangers, right? You mentioned the writer's strike and the actor's strike that is the actor's one is still going on. The writers, they did reach an agreement. You know, what's crazy for the actors, you know, they were looking at, obviously writers, we get it. AI writing scripts, writing stories, totally understand why writers would be concerned. But what was really interesting to me is actors were concerned because they were losing their digital likenesses. And, you know, now they could do a great performance a few times and then be out of work because a digital version of them could be used forever for whatever new, you know, shows or movies were going to be made. So I wonder if there's a parallel on the game development side where, you know, if studios start to train their own in-house AI, you know, models on the work that the employees have done. Like I'm thinking of like Blizzard, right? With really unique art style, or Riot, you know, what if, you know, they started to train AI on the in-house art style, that could really impact the need going forward for, you know, the art teams, right? Because the AI is like, well, we already have our style that's set and established, and now we can create new stuff without the need of as many artists. So that's concerning, right? That kind of sucks. And, you know, I think that kind of is the dark side that I'm curious about within the games industry.
Yeah, definitely. That was a perfect example. And oftentimes it's like we talk a lot in terms of executives talk naturally a lot about the positives, because it's unlikely that the AI is going to impact their jobs negatively, most likely positively, because the profitability of the company will increase if their costs decrease and the output stays the same, or even if the output increases, everything just is better for the executives. But I think, you know, we touched upon the Capcom's president saying that $70 is still not enough for a AAA game, and kind of like overall in the industry, the prices of developing games have been increasing while the revenues at large haven't been increasing at the same space across all the vectors. And yeah, it's interesting how much, especially console side of games will lean into AI, because when kind of looking from afar or at the console business, it is, you know, it is growing significantly. I think it was over 7% a year over year, but that growth is really fueled by the fact that the games were delayed in the prior years, and so all the great games are launching right now. And there's no supply chain issues where people are not being able to get the PS5s or other devices. And so when looking at the console games overall, like it seems like they're kind of like targeting all kinds of business models. Like they have paid games, they have paid plus microtransactions, there's subscription services that are definitely not growing at the pace that they expected. We saw that with the latest Microsoft leaks and so the growth has tapered and not at the level that it needs to be to pay such an egregious amount of what they paid for content. And then you also have games as a service with the Destinies and other type of titles that are in development. I think Microsoft said that they had 10 games as a service titles in development. Those are huge time sinks because they focus on engagement over the initial price, you know, the paid price. So what is going to be the future kind of there and how much they will lean into AI, because they're already leaning into accessibility in terms of cloud gaming, in terms of handheld devices. So kind of like the next step, if they can't continue increasing the price, if the user base is not growing as fast as it needs to hold all these expensive games, then the next step is going to be reduction of the costs. And the cost reduction can come in either through, you know, reducing the size of the teams or just increasing the efficiency of the existing teams, or quite often both.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, you know, there's the console market side of it, and there's also what you just talked about with the impact on team sizes. But yeah, I mean, the console market, that's an interesting one where, as you said, it's still been growing, but it finally is, I feel like, catching up in the variety of business models that we've seen on obviously PC, but also in mobile. You know, console has been a little slow, definitely impacted a lot by the pandemic. Big games have been coming out recently, which is great. But I think one of the, you know, to come back to what you had asked in a moment, but I think it's also informed by what some research has shown recently with just the way the macro economy is impacting households and the disposable income that they have to spend. There's a shift in the hardware mix where, and this I think could be really impactful on the next round, the next cycle that's coming out. It's already having an impact, but the fact that a lot of lower income households are really sort of backing away from the console expenditures because it is so expensive, and households that are bringing in over 100,000 or more a year have shifted more towards the console, and households spending 50K or less a year have been shifting away. And that was a recent report that I was reading about that. And that really means like, okay, when the next generation systems come in and they're more expensive, and like you mentioned, if games go up to $100 each for a game on console, that's going to really further squeeze out the lower income households. And that's really concerning because it, you know, that I think disproportionately impacts younger people, college kids, you know, a lot of the folks that are kind of maybe earlier in their gaming life. And that's going to be a huge impact for console. And then that comes to the business models, right? So not only do the costs of making games impact the business models, but do the shifting in the demographics impact them as well? And I'm really curious, you know, I think personally, and from what we look at over at Exolo, we really look at live ops and free-to-play games as the ones that have a lot of growth potential. You know, premium paid content, paid games, those really nicely curated, crafted, you know, kind of PlayStation single player experiences. You know, that's questionable. Like how are those going to survive as the costs go up and perhaps the user base shrinks, you know, and the shift focuses more to maximizing the revenue you can get out of every launch. So I think that's, you know, it's going to have I don't know what the answer is, but I'm really curious what the impact is going to be on the types of games made based on these business models. And then, yeah, I think we all subscription, you know, I think it has a place in the market. And perhaps as we see this divide where There's a certain segment of the audience that is more price sensitive. Maybe subscriptions, you know, will become more appealing, right, to a growing number of players. But I'm not sure it really is the realm of the AAA content, which is really looking at maximizing all of, you know, you have to recoup $1 billion just to break even, right? So a Game Pass subscription is just not going to do that for you, even with those big numbers that were being paid. So I think a lot of unknowns for console.
Yeah, 100%. Chris, we've talked almost about everything from behavioral economics to real economics to console to AI to IPs. Let's end it on a positive note and talk about your latest release from Exola, which is the Exola Mall. It's a traffic generating platform, which is a very nice thing in the post-ATT era. I was going through the site. So you have a traffic generation platform. You have access to influencers to actually drive traffic to the Exola Mall. You have your custom landing page for your game, which allows you to run campaigns, not only the influencer campaigns, but traditional performance marketing campaigns. And most importantly, you offer the web store where you can reduce the platform fees. And that is very important in nowadays, especially with ATT that has reduced our ability to do very efficient user acquisition, as well as all these tech stacks, Unity included, that are increasing the costs and killing a lot of developers with 1,000 paper cuts, not Unity specifically, but you know, you have to pay for your attribution, you have to pay for everything that your data analytics, etc. And those are eating away the margins that the web store helps to improve. But what is Exola Mall? Like, I haven't used it, just read about it. Looks like a really cool release.
Yeah, thank you. So Exola Mall, it is a online destination for video games. It really opens a new distribution channel. And, you know, to step away from the marketing speak for a moment, it, you know, it's a mall. Think about a mall, which is a place that you can go and you can sample everything and you get a whole variety of different options, whether it's games, you get a variety of different offerings, all of this stuff under one roof. And for us, Exola Mall, it's x.la is the landing page. And it's kind of a combination of a distribution platform where you can go there and go to specific game pages to buy a game or download it directly. You can also go there. It combines also drops or special offers. So think of kind of a combination of a digital store combined with a sort of a Prime Gaming drops environment, and then combined with a place where influencers can set up their own pages and promote things themselves. Also a marketplace where you can top up your game accounts. So it really brings all the different ways that you know, game companies are sort of bringing their products to market under one roof, under this mall, and creates a single destination for players to go to. It is a business-to-consumer facing product. It's our first B2C product that we've offered. So we're really excited around that. And, you know, you touched on it. There's the landing pages, exclusive in-game items, game discounts, premium experiences, all from developers and influencers through these campaigns. So for developers, they can showcase and monetize their content with these specific branded landing pages. So you don't have to come in through the front door of the mall. You can, if you have a game, you can have your own dedicated landing page that you can directly ultra straight to, and you start to get the analytic, not only the business, but the analytics around what's going on there, which often we don't get when we go through third-party platforms. And it allows you to customize it and run that yourself. But then also for influencers, it allows them to create their own branded pages. So if you had an influencer, and they had their own skin in your game, they could actually create a page and tell their audience to go to that page to get that skin and then get your game. And we handle all of that attribution and the payouts on the money that's generated from it on the back end. So it really combines everything all in one place. It builds upon a lot of our tech that we already have for going direct to consumer. Also combines our partner network, which is a influencer platform that we've been running for a while. And it really aligns with our mission to help the game community and bring everybody together. So cool new way to reach new audiences, you know, get more data about how your game's doing, and work with influencers, and yeah, just a lot of fun.
Awesome release from Exola. There's a lot of services that we need to pay as developers, and this is actually one of those services that increases our margins. so in that sense,
yeah just 5%, by the way. It's only 5%.
Yeah. So in that sense, a very, very valuable service. Thank you, Chris, cool. for coming on a podcast at 5 a.m. and discussing all these complicated topics. I wouldn't be able to do this at that time of the day, but you're sharp at all times of the day. So I always appreciate to have you on the podcast.
Likewise, Mishka. Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. It's been fun.
Thanks for everybody for listening, and check out the new mall in town. So goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the whole episode. If you like this podcast, please do leave a comment and share the episode. If you want to access the Deconstructor of Fun community with hundreds of senior games folk, go to our website and apply to the Slack group. And if you want to get notified of all the new content we have coming out every week, do subscribe to the weekly Deconstructor of Fun newsletter. Finally, do remember, we love you guys and we appreciate you guys. Catch you next time.